thing I will ask to people from behind to come to see us because we are not so much. So could you please just go in front? And also the person who will present something, it's better that they are in the first line. So it will be better when I will ask them to come to present something. Thank you. Our first presenter, he's from Korea. So I think he's not here. Okay. Good. Choi Jong-dae is not here also. Okay. So, Reese Nancy, tu peux venir? Okay, could you please make joke in English because no one understand your joke in French? Okay, tu te mets où tu veux. You have 3 minutes.
Hello, my name is Nancy Reze. I'm a PhD student in IRSTEA Montpellier, and my laboratory is in Aix-Marseille University. I work in the chemical and biological clogging within pipes and emitters using treated wastewater in irrigation. So this is my work. It's divided into two parts, the chemical parts and the biological part. In the chemical part, also it's divided into two parts, experimental and modelization. In the experimental part, I use Beckers, and in the Beckers, I put treated wastewater, and I change two parameters, the pH and the temperature, and I see the mass of the chemical precipitation when I change the pH and the temperature. And in the second part, which is the modelization part, I use Frixe. It's a geochemical model that shows the saturation index of each element. And at the end, I use the Taylor-Couette reactor to develop biofilms. And then I quantify the quantity of biofilms developed on PE plates. So if you have questions, please don't hesitate.
Okay, you have
it's 3 minutes,
more.
Good?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, 150.
Ah, 150, more, okay.
Yeah.
So I can sing. So if you have questions.
Okay, maybe we can ask questions at the end because I'm not sure we have enough time.
Ask questions?
Yeah.
Somebody understand what I said.
Maybe. Okay. Our next presenter, Maria Luprano.
Merci. Merci.
Could you speak English?
Yes.
Okay.
Good afternoon to everybody. My name is Maria Laura Luprano and I come from the Water Research Institute in Rome, Italy. My research topics, I have a research fellow and my research topics are the evaluation of hygienization efficiency of innovative wastewater treatment plants and the optimization of biomolecular methods for detection of pathogens and antibiotic-resistant genes in sludge and wastewaters. As you know, treated wastewater irrigation is becoming prevalent in arid regions of the world due to growing demand and decline in freshwater supplies. However, the spread of antibiotic-resistant genes has recently raised a great concern for the risk of transferring antibiotic-resistant genes to pathogens, which may hinder the use of recycled water for agricultural irrigation. And in particular, wastewater treatment plants are considered one of the main hotspots of the spread of antibiotic resistance into the environment. In this study shown in this poster, by using a qPCR assay, we evaluated the fate and the removal of four antibiotic resistant genes in two different wastewater treatment plants. A technological system, namely SBBGR, sequencing batch biofilter granular reactor, and then natural wastewater treatment plants made up of constructed wetland, horizontal subsurface constructed wetlands. Both of them followed by different tertiary treatments and during a 1 year sampling period. Our results showed that both the systems efficiently reduced the level of all the antibiotic resistant genes, achieving logarithmic removal values up to 2 log units of gene copies per mL. Although constructed wetlands reduced the gene level, but with variable efficiency between genes and different sampling season. Moreover, no enhancement of effluence quality was obtained by different tertiary treatments, in particular UV and lagooning, respectively for SBBGR and constructed wetlands. So in conclusion, we concluded that the antibiotic resistance spread should be monitored and mitigated, and in particular a deeper knowledge of the antibiotic resistance process removal is necessary to enhance the full potentialities of these two systems. Thank you very much for your attention.
Thank you.
For any further questions, I'll be available. Okay.
Thank you. Our next presenter, is he here? Okay, he's not here. Isaac Oladipo is not here also. Aliot Sebastian Ricardo is not here. And okay, he's not here. Sakata Satoshi.
Okay, my name is Satoshi Sakata from Japan. My first name is Satoshi, is the same name Japanese recipients of the Nobel Prize in this year. So, don't need problem. unfortunately, the Satoshi is the famous general name in Japan. So many people in Japan say this name, so it's not scarce. My research main purpose of this study is developing adaptation of climate change for the rice farmer. So I want to say mainly the background this experiment. So generally in Japan, the higher temperature in summer, the better the yield increase, but the quality is degrade. So so Japanese customer give weight the quality the products, especially foods such as taste, not only taste but also brightness, color, grain size, and so on. So if the yield in is increased, but the farmer income is the down to degrade the rice grain. So water management play a significant role in preventing to generate the heat damage of rice, and we have studies developed that technique. So past study include us focus on the surface irrigation. The experimental is we use a sprinkler. The reason is to use a sprinkler is the aim of the cooling the panicle directly. So just as this experimentation is as an initial stage, we change irrigation time. The results show the picture right side shows the irrigation at the evening. We irrigated the most effective cooling down the temperature compared to morning and daytime. So more detail in the poster, the character size is very small, so upstairs poster, and please watch if you want. Thank you.
Thank you for your presentation. Our next presenter, Olena Babitska, is not here. Oh Chong Chu is not here also. Zaim Barai, he has to come, but Barb Audrey. Merci.
Thank you. Bon, I'm not Audrey Barb, of course. she is a student from I'm Frédéric Rossel from Montpellier Institut des Régions Chaudes. And today she's working in Tunisia. So she is not here, but prepare the poster, and I will try to present you what does she do during this presentation. She spent 6 months in the Tchout oasis in south of Morocco near Agadir, and where there is a project of conversion to drip irrigation in the area. So the question was, there is tourism in this area, because this is a picture of the site of the oasis. It's not too far from Agadir, and it's 100 kilometers from Agadir. And there is some tours of tourists from Agadir to Tchout Oasis to spend the day, and it's not too far. And these tourists came to see palm trees, water flowing in the canals. And there is a project to convert all the oasis to drip irrigation. So she analyzed this. These are the picture of the canal, the reason, one of the reasons why the tourists came here. And to understand if it's feasible to this transformation, she analyzed and tried to understand how does it work through the years. Maybe you can go for the following one. The next, yes. The next one again, okay. So is to know that there is drip irrigation in all the area around this area. In the Tarudant area, there is a PPP program like we will have tomorrow with the BRL and with orange trees, palm tree, and lot of irrigation vegetables. With drip irrigation. So the people, the farmers have this experience of drip irrigation. Then this was this. She tried to understand how does we arrived at the situation today. So she analyzed through the last centuries, how does it work? It grows and sometimes it's reduced in size due to drought or to water availability. So we can see that there is some times where the oasis is big, larger, and smaller. It depends on the water availability. And today, in the since 2010, the oasis is growing thanks to pumping in the underground water. And in this area in red, since 5 years, there is pumping and drip irrigation developing in this area by the main family of the oasis. And their project is to convert all the oasis to drip irrigation. So here came the conflict between this interest to develop agronomy and the persistence of tourism in this area. And so she did a long work to try to analyze the drip irrigation project and to see how can they manage with this. So she arrived with maybe some several propositions to develop the drip irrigation in the lower part and upstream to save the oasis and the shim. But this agriculture is less productive than the other ones, so maybe they have to think about tourism, maybe to pay a little bit for this kind of agriculture, because if this kind of agriculture does not exist, they will not have any more tourism in the area, because the idea is that, oh yeah, I will pass this.
You have 1 minute to conclude.
Drip irrigation is this, and maybe the palm tree is this one. So, yeah. So the conclusion is maybe they have to find a compromise between both of them, and it's not so easy to find with to go ahead with a project. So maybe I can try to answer the question upstairs in front of the poster.
Okay, thank you. Okay, Zhang Mingyong is not here. Abbas Muhammad. Yeah, when she... Okay. I just go... Okay. So, okay, he's not here. I know Faryab is not here. If I could see. Okay.
So I'm Wafa El Khomsi from Morocco. I'm a PhD student in the Institute of Agronomic and Veterinary Hassan II. I present today part of my work on the contribution of saline groundwater table to date palm water use in the oasis area. It's an oasis area in the southern east of Morocco. So, in arid regions, water resources are very limited. So we try to study the contribution of groundwater table to supply crops' water requirements, especially date palms. The main objective is to understand the interaction between groundwater shallow saline table and date palm transpiration. We have two second objectives. The first is to follow up the effects of shallow water table on date palm root developments. And the second is to determine the contribution of groundwater table on date palm trees' water consumption. For doing this, we was adopt an experimental approach, which is divided in three parts. The first is the characterization or the mapping of date palm root system. The second was the estimation of date palm transpiration in the absence of irrigation. And the third is the monitoring of soil moisture. And all this, of course, in order to determine the contribution of date palm in the contribution of groundwater in date palm water consumption. So our results show that the root system of date palm can reach very deep it can reach up 9 meters. So we conclude that he can extract water directly from the water table. And the principal results reveal that saline shallow water table can contribute at 50% of the water of the date palm water consumption, and this contribution depends on soil property, variety of date, the variety species, and of course the soil characteristics. Especially the water transmission. So, as a conclusion, we can say that this determination of this contribution can help us to determine more and know with a very good way the water requirement of date palm. And thank you.
Thank you very much. Is quite Samet Moussa is no, he's not here. Karen Villot, please come.
Thank you. Yes. So I'm Karen from IMI, International Water Management Institute. I'm a principal researcher, and I'm going to present some results that we have worked on here on estimating the contribution of groundwater to global food production. And in particular, we were focusing on the role of the groundwater depletion to food production. Okay, so this gives you some earlier estimates. The first bullet is actually not related to the food production, but more to the area that groundwater contributes in terms of irrigation, and that's about 43% on a global scale. If we look at the food production, there's only been one citation that I could find that relates to this, and it says that 10% of the world's agricultural food production depends on using mined groundwater, and it's not possible to see where that figure came from when you try to dig into the literature. So we think the work that we have done is sort of the first time that it's actually been constrained more specifically. So just telling you that 67% of groundwater globally is used for agriculture, and about 20% of all water abstraction is coming from groundwater. So it's actually quite a lot of our groundwater that goes to irrigation and food production. This doesn't come through at all, huh? Okay, so I'll have to explain. So basically this explains the approach that we use to determine how much food is derived from groundwater globally. We used basically two data sets. So one was a global data set on global food production. It's a SPAM data set. So it gives food production from different categories of irrigation and from different sources. And the second set of data was global data on groundwater depletion derived from global hydrological modeling, which has determined and mapped the areas that have groundwater depletion at a certain extent, either little or high. So we haven't really categorized what level of depletion. We're just saying, okay, it's depleting if groundwater is being abstracted at a higher rate than it's being replenished. That's the definition we used. And then we overlaid the two data sets to see in those areas where both groundwater is used and where depleted groundwater is used, how much food production is being produced in those areas. And these data pertain to 2005, so it's already 10 years ago, and maybe they're sort of a bit out of date already, but that's the best that we could do at the moment. we separated into different regions when we came up with the results. So basically, we did the assessment at a gridded basis on 5 minutes, but then we accumulated the results into these regions. And then we also aggregated the database on the food production, which had 42 crops, but we only looked at 9 crops at the end. So some of the results and key figures that we found was that groundwater irrigated area globally contributes or comprise about 83.1 million hectares, or about 41% of total irrigated areas. And that is pretty much what the first bullet point in the first slide said, so it's kind of giving us an indication that we are tracking this these areas correctly. Then when we look at the contribution from depleting aquifers, it says that 15.5 to 18.6% of the irrigated aquifers are actually supplied by depleting groundwater. And the rate of the depletion that we came up with was 129 cubic kilometers per year, and that accounts for 78% of total groundwater depletion. So most of the groundwater depletion in the world is actually is happening within the irrigation or agricultural sector. What has happened? You can't even see the data. Maybe I can go back.
You have 1 minute to conclude.
Can we go to the actual poster, or you don't have it up?
It's at the end. At the end.
It's at the end. Okay, that's fine. How much do you have? Half minute? I don't worry. There's nobody here, no? I'll see if I can go to the poster and show you the data. Come on. Here we go. So up there with the orange, that's a table that I wanted to show. Yeah, it's okay now. Yes, so in the first row there, is being put by groundwater in general, whether it's depleting or not depleting. And you can see that of the of total irrigated food production, 43% of that derives from groundwater. And if you take it as a fraction of the total food production, whether irrigated or rain-fed, the groundwater fraction is 13%. Now, if you focus only on the depleting groundwater and how much food is being produced by that, you can see that that contributes 14 to 17% of all groundwater produced food. If you take it as a fraction of the irrigated food production, it's 6 to 7%, and of the total food, including rain-fed, it's 2%. So it's just giving you some figures. I'm going to go back now and see if we can still look at the other results. So here it's sort of separated out to the various regions, and what we see that is that these three regions, which are Central Asia and North Near East and North Africa and the OECD, these red ones have been shifted again, sorry. But they comprise 90% of the regional areas that generate the food production from depleting aquifers. This is not good. I mean, these rings are not around the right numbers. I'll go to the next one. So if what I wanted to show you here is then the distribution, not in terms of regions, but in terms of the crops that are contributing to groundwater depletion. And what we found is that you can see the big numbers there in column 2. So the cereals, the roots and tubers and the sugar crops, they are mostly responsible for groundwater depletion. Look at the second last column. You can see that some of the crops are actually producing more than the average from groundwater depletion, and those are again the sugar crops, the roots and tubers, the vegetables, and the leguminous crops. So what this tells us is that these crops are preferentially grown with groundwater depletion. Going forward, we are now, because this, the results that I showed you was kind of a snapshot, so now we're trying to look at scenarios and what happens into the future with some of these things, and we're using this global model and improving it. So basically we are including this lower compartment of the groundwater system, because this was not present in the previous model. And the reason for doing that is when we want to estimate the depletion of groundwater globally, we need to keep track of this lower compartment. Before, in the model, it was basically an infinite resource, so you could just draft with no limits. And what happens eventually is that these aquifers will run out. And so we are including this now in the new model, and to be able to do that, we then need information about the storage in these different aquifers, and so we need this input here, the groundwater thickness, and then we will be able to see actually how long it will take before the aquifers run out of water. Okay, so conclusions: groundwater food production depends on depleting groundwater for 2% of the total, 6.7% of the irrigated, and 15.5% of the global of the groundwater irrigated fractions in 2005. Reliance on non-sustainable groundwater for increasing parts of global food production requires urgent attention, and solutions to be found in broader global food policies and interventions in both developing and developed part of the world. I won't go into details on that. Thanks.
Thank you. Sorry. Is Irina Pondarakis not here? Okay. Joma Ihab is not here. Also. Sabori Mohammed is not. Okay, he will arrive there. Okay, Philippe Kero.
So, does it work or is it going to jump like
no,
this?
No, it's working. I think it's working, yeah.
Okay, can you put the previous picture, please? Thank you, everybody. Come. Thank you, Karen. Karen has made, unknowingly, a very, very good introduction. I'm going to talk about groundwater depletion for nothing. So, you were talking about South Africa. We just moved all the way up to the continent, and we are in Algeria. Most specifically, we are in Ouargla, so this is, we are start entering the deep desert, deep Sahara desert. There is no rain, 150 millimeters of rain per year. When it rains, it has happened from time to time, you get wet in a minute, but other than that, it does not rain. Next slide, please. So, on the these two pictures, do we have a laser? Or it's...
No.
Okay, so you've got... the landscape is more or less where you have the people that are working over there. We are in the desert. We pump fossil groundwater for drinking purposes and for mining, for oil. Oil needs a lot of water. This water is collected and recycled into these treatment works. These treatment works, after, the water goes into a canal 40 kilometers in the middle of the desert. End of story. So, since this water is fossil, since it is non-renewable, since people do eat anyway over there, since the food comes from those, from Algeria and from 1,000 kilometers away, why not using a little bit of this water, treated, do some agriculture and to demonstrate that it works. Oh, by the way, I forgot. Everybody is doing it illegally. So in fact, we're just going to demonstrate to the official that we can do it. But all the farmers over there, like in the rest of Africa, 80% of the food production on markets is irrigated with treated and untreated wastewater. Yes, apparently, figure from this conference. No, in Africa in general, in developing developing world, we can discuss that. So, in our project, we take the water from the treatment works. We've built greenhouses, 9, and we're going to compare 3 types of water quality. So, treated wastewater. We're going to take the same treated wastewater, we're going to put it through membrane, because we want to see the effectiveness of membranes to remove the bad guys. So there are 2 main bad guys that we were looking at, heavy metals and pathogens. And we looked at Escherichia coli only. And then we have the control, because the control is the groundwater, is the first groundwater. There is layers of groundwater, and the first one is 80 meters deep. And this is also what the locals are using. After a while, the longest is to wait the container to come. But then to build everything, it was done in 3 days. And 3 months later, we have tomatoes, salad, beetroot, potatoes. We compare 3 types of plants. We are worried about food safety, food contamination. And contamination, it depends on the interface. So, 3 types of interface. The biggest interface is R4. The parts of the plant that we eat are in the ground. So, either the rooting system for the beetroot, potatoes. Hey, stars. For the potatoes, well, it's not a root, it's a leaf. They're also underground. So, we look at beetroot and tomatoes. Then we look at plants where we are eating. The part that we are eating is on the surface, so cucumber. And we look at plants which are not supposed to be in contact with water. We're using drip irrigation. So lettuce, which is a leaf. Sorry for the potatoes. Potatoes is not a leaf. And tomatoes, because tomato is a fruit. And literature illustrates that accumulation of heavy metals is different depending on the roots, leaf system, and fruits. 3 months later, we have our salad. We've got the beetroot, 2.6 kilograms for the beetroot. With the leaf, not just the beetroot. And it worked. And it worked during the winter, because in the desert, you cannot work during the summer. From May to September, it's just too warm. We actually had, in May, 50 degrees in the greenhouse. In May. But during the winter, from October to May, we think we can do up to 3 harvests. We've done only 2 from May, from end of November to May, but we think we can make 1 more. And I think I've overpassed the 3 minutes.
Yeah, but it's okay, you can continue because you are the last one.
Okay, so I'm going to start everything from scratch again.
Okay.
Very interesting results on that, literature is full of recommendations against salt, and salt salinization is an issue, and plants do not grow on salt. A big surprise of this experimental setup is that the wastewater is salty. The first aquifer, unconfined, is salty, and it drowns the city, and the local authority decided to drain the aquifer and to bring it up to the treatment works, because then it is pumped 40 kilometers away. So the treatment works is a mix of domestic water plus saline water. And throughout the year, we have 7 grams of salt per liter. And we had to use it. So it was removed by the membrane, but for the treated wastewater, it was still irrigated with 7 grams of liters. And we had the best results. So we can grow on salt. Exactly why we still don't know, because this is not aligned with current literature and current results. But we do think that the organic matters and elements brought by wastewater overcome the effect of salt. Okay.
Thank you. So we have like half an hour, so you can just add comments or add questions if you want, or if you wanted. What?
Yes.
You don't have your picture? Okay.
You want to take a picture with me?
Any comments or questions or in English?
The experiment is only for one winter, isn't it?
It is for as long as the locals maintain it.
But for the moment, it's only the results are with only one winter.
Yes, one winter.
Maybe it's the reason why it's working with the salt, because generally you need several years of salt in the soil. If there is several years of drip water, you have a lot of too many salt. If there is only one winter, maybe it's not that excess of salt to be able to grow. Maybe it can be a start of explanation. But
I want to have a look at that, but I'm not anymore in control of this experiment. Yes, because some of the water is groundwater, so we're actually rinsing with fresh groundwater on the soil. Another source of water is so treated wastewater, but filtrated with ultrafiltration, and we remove this ultrafiltration, remove the salt. So we also flushing the salt from the soil, and another one is salty. Nevertheless, we had the best results with the salty water. But the salty water is the treated wastewater, so it is the water with the highest NPK and also all the oligo elements. And we identify some carence. I don't know, you translate, huh? Yeah. No, the deficiency in oligo elements in some plants that might explain disease, leaves turning yellow, low yield. And even the green, you can actually see that the plants do not have the same green. Treated wastewater is a super fertilizer.
Any comments, any questions more? If you want to add something on your presentation, because also all the presentation were very short, maybe Karen, yeah.
Déjà, tu parles à l'Assemblée et tout.
I'm here to...
Ok, c'est bon.
De ce côté.
You can take a picture with your photo.
And on a job. So, here you have the biofilms developed on PE plates. And the weight of biofilms. C'est bon? C'est bon? Ah, ok.
No, not soprano.
No, no.
Italian. Ah, Italian.
No.
You want? I can take it.
With mine, I can. They were supposed to be 30. Allora, sei di Roma? Io invece sono italiana, di Genova. Chiamo Maria Chiara Tostullo, allora.
Ça va être plus simple. Okay. Je suis pas gros.
Voilà.
Okay.
Je ne suis pas gros, ils ont posé avec les Français, ils adorent faire des films comme ça.